great woman that Elisha has encountered. We saw, among other things, the great woman was observant. She was wise. She was kind and gracious, 2 Kings chapter 4. She was motivated. She was humble. She was content. And also, I made brief mention the last time that we were beginning to see how Elisha was working on the training of his servant Gehazi. He never made it to the actual birth of the son. So we're going to pick up there. Look at verse 17 with me. And again, I'll try and be not too long here. The woman conceived and bare a son at that season. Remember, we made some comments about being a season and a time, and it's prevalent in this passage, that Elisha had said to her, according to the time of life. Need pause for just a second. Let's not do like some folks do so many times. They read the Bible, they speed right past a sentence like that. What it's telling us is so basic in one way that we just kind of, yep, she had a kid, okay, move on. But it's utterly marvelous in another way. Women conceive all the time and have children. Nothing unusual about that, except we've already been told that this woman has not had a child. And we've also discerned that her husband is apparently too old for her to consider him able to father a child. There's been a passing of time. It's really prevalent. And it's hardly noticeable unless we ponder the implications of what's going on here. 9 months of pregnancy, nursing a couple of years back in that culture, maybe as many as 3 or 4, toddler stage a few more years, until the next verse we read that the child is grown. What's not said, and it's safe to assume, is that Elisha and Gehazi have been watching all of this, all their travels back and forth. This woman didn't put an addition on her house because she only saw Elisha once or twice. She put it on there because she'd seen him a lot, and he's constantly going back and forth. They've been watching this during this passage of time. They've observed the child. Verse 18, when the child was grown, passage of time, it fell on a day, there it is again, that he went out to his father to the reapers. There's our expression. When this gift of a son went out to see his father and the reapers. Now, there's not too much to go on for his actual age. We're never even told a kid's name, let alone his birthday. He's been weaned, of course. He's old enough to be able to walk out into the field on his own. Probably not old enough to be a reaper, or his father would have probably put him to work. So can we guess that he is somewhere between 6 and 7 on the low end, and maybe 10 or 11 on the high end? Does that sound like a reasonable guess on our part? So the narrative continues. Here's this young lad. And he said to his father, verse 19, my head, my head! And he said to a lad, the father said to the lad, carry him to his mother. There are a couple things we ought to ask about this. First, the father is obviously not so old that he still can't be out in the field with his reapers. So what's he doing? He's supervising. I like to tease my son-in-law and my son now. Listen, I waited a lot of years to get to the place where I can sit in that nice new easy chair and you go fix such and such. And they all give me the dirty look, you know. He's supervising. Secondly, the father doesn't take the son himself. He orders a lad to carry the son. Well, the son must not have been too big because the lad wouldn't have been able to carry him if he was like Keith. You know, Keith, what are you, 16 now, 17? You know, have you tried to pick up Keith lately? The last time I wrestled my son Glenn was in 2001, and we got into it on the living room floor, and he bruised 4 ribs, and that was the end of that. He was 16. Fourth, the instruction to take the son to the mother. By now, it ought to be obvious to you and me and everyone else that this is the spiritual leader in the home. Mom is. Guys, do not give up spiritual leadership in your home to your wife. You may love her dearly. She may be very capable. She may be Dana, learning all that stuff from Justin, and has her own college degree in a Bible college. But do not turn over the spiritual headship of the family to the wife. That's not a knock on women. That's the way God set it up. So keep reading. Verse 20. When he had taken him, he brought him to his mother. The lad brings the child to the mother, and the lad sat on her knees until noon and then died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door upon him and went out. All this happens before noon, because it says she sat on his lap until noon and then he died. Secondly, let's be really clear. He died. Dead. This is not a coma. This is not sunstroke. This is not a deep faint and then some sleep. Verse 20, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. The Hebrew word is muth. M-O-O-T-H would be a phonetic spelling. Look at verse 32. Skip ahead. We're going to cheat. When Elisha was come into the house, behold, the child was dead and laid upon the bed. Same Hebrew word, muth. Look at chapter 8. Turn to chapter 8 with me. We'll do this quickly. Chapter 8, look at verse 1. This is a little bit later in the narrative of Elisha's life. Elisha spake unto the woman whose son he had restored to life. So he's now visiting the woman again. He says, arise, go you and your household, sojourn wheresoever you can sojourn, for the Lord has called for a famine, and it shall come upon the land 7 years. Whoa. So Elisha here in chapter 8, and we'll get there, he's still interacting with this Shunammite woman. And he says, listen, the Lord said there's a famine coming. Get out of here. So she rose and did after the saying of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines for 7 years. Point in verse 1 is, what does it say? Whose son he had restored to life. If you restore life, what did you have to have? Dead, right? Okay, now look down at verse 5 in chapter 8. Came to pass, as he was telling the king how he had restored, this is Gehazi speaking to the king. And the king had said in verse 4, tell me all the great things Elisha has done. And Elisha says, he's telling the king how he, Elisha, restored a dead body to life. That behold, woman, and then the narrative goes on, it says restored to life, and then in the end of verse 5 says, whom Elisha restored, same word, mut, all those times. That word mut, by the way, is sort of like our English word, moot, M-O-O-T. What is a moot argument? It's dead. It's a dead, you don't need it, it's a dead argument. The gift of the Son, the birth of this son, ranks right up there with some of the greatest miracles in the Old Testament. The son is dead. And this great woman does what? She springs into action. And can I just say, and don't take this the wrong way now, because I know somebody's going to go out of here and say, Pastor Kuhar said, sometimes you don't have to pray. So here it comes. Sometimes praying isn't what we ought to be doing. Sometimes you just need to act. You need to do. Don't take that comment wrong. Let me finish. Men ought always to pray, no doubt about it. But sometimes the Lord says, would you stop praying and get to work? If you see a child wandering out into a busy street, that is not a time to get on the prayer chain and ask everybody to pray that your wayward child would walk out in the street. It's time to get up off that porch seat and get out there and get that kid. Then you pray and thank the Lord that you could see the kid and you're still able to go out there and get him, especially when you're old parents like us. There was a time when this little four-year-old used to run back and forth between these two trees in the front yard. Constantly. Stay away from the street. You go get her. No, it's your turn. This mama bear, this great woman, acts. She called unto her husband. She said, verse 22, send me, I back in chapter 4, send me, I pray thee, one of the young men and one of the donkeys, that I may run to the man of God and come again. Hey, she got to run. There's an urgency there. It's an imperative. The word send is an imperative. She wants to go find Elisha, the man of God, and she doesn't want to wait around. It's not time to get on the phone and do the prayer chain thing. The urgency there. Apparently, she doesn't tell her husband why either. Look at how he responds in verse 23. Well, what do you want to do that today for? Oh, no reason. It's neither the new moon or the Sabbath. And she said, don't worry, it's going to be good. That's a non-answer, guys. It's also a demonstration of her faith, guys and ladies. We husbands, we sometimes get these. Please just do as I ask and don't ask why. Don't ask any questions. Guys, let me tell you, when that happens, it's usually just best to say, yes, dear, and do it. So she goes off. The dead body of her son is safely hidden in the room that she had designated for Elisha. Nobody's going to go in there. That's Elisha's private quarters. Verse 24. She saddles the donkey, said to her servant, drive. Go forward. Slack not your riding for me, except I say so. No stopping at the sheets and off the interstate. Just get going. So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. Now, that's about 10 miles away. And it came to pass when the man of God saw her from afar off. He saw her. He says to Gehazi, behold, yonder is the Shunammite. Run now, I pray thee, and meet her and say to her, is it well with thee? Is it well with thy husband? Is it well with the child? See, there's a vested interest in this family. Elisha's got an interest here, and she answered, it's well. And here's where I pause and I scratch my head. That just fascinates me. This gift to a barren woman of her only son, in fact, her only child, period, who has just died, and she says, that's well. You know what it reminds me of, Paul? The song, It Is Well. His life was in turmoil. It is well. Truth is, she's speaking to Gehazi, not Elisha. And she doesn't want to tell Gehazi. This woman is a great woman, remember? When we examined her character attributes, I ran through a few of them before we just started there. Her greatness extended to her wisdom and her discernment or her perception. Somehow, this lady knows what we readers don't know yet, is that Gehazi is not the man of faith that Elisha is. Somehow, she has perceived that. And that's going to get confirmed when you get to chapter 5. This is, though, is the first hint to you and I, the reader, that there's something wrong here. Verse 27, she came to the man of God to the hill where he was. She caught him by the feet, but Gehazi came here to cast her away or to thrust her away. I'm going to tell you, that's not the reaction that the man of God would have. A real man of God would not cast someone in desperate need away. He's paying attention. Then he rebukes Gehazi. The man of God said, let her alone. Her soul's vexed within her. If that had been me, it would have been, what is wrong with you? Can't you see this woman is hurting? Get out of here. But Elisha's a little more pleasant than me. He says, no, let her be. Her soul's vexed. The Lord hath hid it from me and has not told me. You see, there's a shallowness to Gehazi's faith. And here's the first crack. What about this statement? The Lord hath hid it from me and hath not told me. What has the Lord hidden from Elisha? And our minds immediately think, oh, that's easy. He doesn't know that the gift of the son is dead. Well, that's true enough as far as it goes, but is that all the Lord hasn't shown Elisha yet? What about the truth about Gehazi? Has the Lord not shown Elisha the truth about Gehazi either? This woman has perceived something about Gehazi that Elisha has not, at least not yet. Look at verse 28. She says, did I desire a son, my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? Then he said to Gehazi, Elisha says to Gehazi, gird up thy loins, take thy staff, my staff in your hand, and go your way. If you meet any man, salute him not. If any salute thee, answer him not. Lay my staff on the face of the child. Let's read verse 30. The mother of the child said, as the Lord liveth, and as my soul liveth, I will not leave you. And so Elisha arose and followed her. First thing, verse 28. That's legitimate grief. There's no way in the world we're going to fault this lady for that legitimate grief. But what do we see further? Is that she doesn't trust Gehazi to have the power of God that Elisha has. She knew that for a real answer to her very real problem, she needed the real man of God. She had to go to the source of the original blessing, the man of God. And so she clung to his feet and she said, I'm not going anywhere. And Elisha responded to that impassioned plea. He arose and followed her. They go back the 10 miles. So you've got 10 miles to go, the getting ready, the going, the 10 miles to go, the conversations and meeting Elisha, and then the saddling up and girding up your loins and hurrying back the other way. Verse 32. When Elisha was coming to the house, behold, the child was dead. Same word, and laid upon Elisha's bed. And he went in therefore, and he shut the door upon them both, the two of them, and he prayed unto the Lord. Okay, now's the time to pray. Now it's time to pray. After all, the lad isn't going to get any sicker or any deader. Is deader a word? He's dead. He isn't going to get any deader. There's time to pray. And now you're about to ask God to do something which happens very rarely in the Bible. There is an urgency there, but at this point the time really doesn't matter quite as much. Now we have to think back to Elijah. Remember what Elijah had done to the widow woman's son at Zarephath? He took the child to his room, which is where this child already is, in Elisha's room. And he did what? In 1 Kings chapter 17, he stretched himself upon him three times, and he cried unto the Lord, and he said, O Lord my God, I pray thee, let this child's soul come into him again. That's indicative of genuine death, separation of the immaterial from the material. He prayed and he stretched himself three times on the child. But Elisha, here in verse 34, he went up and he lay upon the child, put his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes, his hands upon his hands. He stretched himself upon the child, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. He prayed and he stretched himself on the child, and already there's a response from the child's body after only one time. Elijah did it. 3. Verse 35. And he returned and he walked in the house to and fro. And then he went up back into his room and stretched himself upon him, and the child sneezed 7 times and the child opened his eyes. Now I know you all want the big answer, right? I would like to know, just like you would like to know, why these two prophets went through this little bit of process. Why it was 3 times with one and only 1.5 or 2 times with the other. Well, I don't know. And so when you don't know, what don't you do? Starts with an S. Speculate. Right? Don't do it. What we do know is that God is the restorer of life, not the procedures that the prophets performed. It wasn't Elisha's staff in Gehazi's hands that was going to do it. It's the power of God that came through God's servants who are men of God. Not like Gehazi. Something else to bear in mind as we wrap up. When Jesus brought Lazarus to life, what did he do? He spoke. What did he say, Nat? Come forth. Yep. What a difference. A certain woman passed by Jesus on his way to Jairus' daughter. Jairus was a ruler in the synagogue, remember? Turn to Mark chapter 5, just for the fun of it. We'll finish here. A certain woman, Mark 5, verse 25, had an issue of blood 12 years, had suffered many things of many physicians, and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. When she heard of Jesus, came in the press and the crowd behind and touched his garment. She said, "If I may touch but his clothes, I shall be whole." Statement of faith, isn't it? And straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the plague. Of course, we know that Jesus then turned and said, "Who touched me?" And that they kind of chuckled, "Well, you're surrounded by people, Lord." And he goes, "No, I perceive virtue now," right? That's a whole fascinating thing. Oh, about Jairus' daughter, same chapter, verse 39. "And when he was come in," Jesus came in, "he said to them, why are you making all this ado? Why are you weeping? This damsel's not dead, she sleeps." And they left him to scorn. They knew she was dead, but when he had put them all out, he took the father and the mother of the damsel and them that were with him, which is Peter, James, and John, and entered in where the damsel was lying, and he took the damsel by the hand, and he said unto her, "Talitha kumi," which being interpreted, "Damsel, I say unto thee, arise." Damsel, arise. Straightway, she sits up, she walks. She was 12 years old. They were astonished with great astonishment. No staffs, no rods, no laying, no breathing, no all this, none of that. The angel said to Mary in Luke 1:37, "For with God nothing shall be impossible." The fact that nothing is impossible with God is stated in the New Testament in various kinds of structures 4 different times. 4 times. Okay, let's finish. Sometimes you have to act immediately. Even in the emergencies of life, do not lose your spiritual discernment. This great woman did not lose her spirit. Her son, only one, only child, has died, and she has not given up her spiritual discernment. Don't waste time with the inconsequential. Don't waste time with Gehazi. Go right to the source of all spiritual power, which is God himself. And don't ever forget, when the crisis is finished, give the glory to God. Martha, tonight. Cindy, tonight. Paul, Tom, give the glory to God when the crisis is over. Verse 37. Well, look at 36. He calls Gehazi and he says, "Call the Shunammite." So Gehazi called her. When she was coming unto him, he said, "Take up your son." Wow. She went in, fell at his feet, bowed herself to the ground, took up her son, and went out. The whole thing is a strange kind of narrative for sure, but it is fascinating how God works.